Gamers Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA1977 on Twitter.
Gamers Netter, just talking to teachers.
So here we are in December, ready to talk about, and I'm going to have to give you the explicit warning now, but we'll come back to that later on. So we're here to talk about Miss I Don't Give a Shit, Engaging with Challenging Behaviour in School by Adele Bates. So again, welcome Adele. Can you just tell us a little bit when we start off with about your career and your journey education to this point?
Yes. So I have been teaching for nearly 20 years. So I started my first teaching role was when I was 12. And I taught a younger child violin because I was playing the violin at the time. And then that turned into singing lessons as well. And then at the age of 14, I set up a drama school in my local town for primary school aged children. And that's how I started teaching. And since then, I've always taught. And in my first career, I was an opera singer. And I always taught alongside that, usually taught performing arts. And I just, over the years, I had such a good time teaching the young people, usually who had behaviour needs. And performing arts is a great subject for that because I could allow them to scream and shout and play angry characters and get a lot of kind of aggression and frustration out. So I really enjoyed it. And then, so I always kind of had that going along. I worked a lot in PRUs, pupil referral units, APs, alternative provisions. And then it got to a point where I was actually enjoying the teaching more than I was enjoying the opera. And so then I thought, well, okay, I'd worked for years and years in schools peripatetically, and then it's that thing, you need your PGCE under your belt. So I thought, okay, I'll get that done. And I went for English. I looked at the government that was in power at the time, and they didn't seem particularly hot on the arts or giving money to it or importance to it within schools. So I thought, well, if I can train in English as an English teacher, I'll be more employable, was my thought. And so I did that. And then, yes, spent some years working in mainstream schools. And I always kind of knew that I would come back round to working with these young people with behaviour needs because I love it so much. And so nowadays I work in between both. I work sometimes in mainstream, sometimes in alternative provision. And I really see myself as a bridge between those two settings. And one of my things I love to do is share the practice between the two, because I really believe that some of the kids that are being excluded from mainstream, it could be prevented if there were more specific practice going on that supports their needs, which I know happens in APs and improves. So that's led me to where I am today. I've kind of got a foot in each camp, mainstream and AP. And I work in schools, I train staff, I support leaders with inclusion around SEMH, social, emotional, mental health issues. I talk a lot, I've written a book. And that's kind of where we're up to today, I think, Phil.
Well, talk a lot and read written a book is two perfect things to be on the podcast. Absolutely. And obviously, we're returning the listener to our favourite topic. Now, Adele, you may not have listened. I don't expect that guests have ever listened, but some of our most streamed or listened to podcasts are around behaviour. And we like to think here that we are quite an inclusive podcast in terms of the range and diversity of opinions that we've had, particularly on behaviour. So if you think we've had Paul Dix, we've had Tom Bennett, we've had Dave Whittaker, we've had Sam Strickland, we've had a lot of different views and opinions. And what I like about what you just said then is that this book is kind of a bridge between alternative provisions and schools. And if you think about it, and I'm sure the listener will agree, a lot of secondaries particularly are kind of blending those two together and having sort of appropriate provision within school for students that may be at the edge or risk of permanent exclusion, or just, you know, find it hard to access the mainstream curriculum. So I'm really looking forward to this discussion. And like I said, the book, and I read a lot of books, Adele, as we talked about before, you know, this is very different. And I mean that in a really good way. It's really kind of eye-opening and refreshing, and it's very, very different. And there's lots of things to discuss in here. So let's get straight into it.
Nailers, Netter, just talking to teachers.
Right, let's get into the questions. So I've just lost them. Oh, here they are. Right.
Sorry.
So you wrote this book for young people for whom the education system does not work. So tell listeners about these students and what they contributed to this book.
I love these students. These pupils are You're not supposed to have favourites, are you? They're obviously not my favourite. So these young people are the kind of young people who, yeah, as you've correctly said, the education system does not work. Now, I'm going to bring this back to the reason I wrote this book. A couple of years ago, I saw an article by Pete Henshaw in SecEd that said 35 pupils a day are being excluded in British schools. 35 a day. And I believe that statistic has gone up to 40 post-pandemic or post-COVID or whatever phase we're in right now. Now, obviously, those statistics kind of move about depending on what you're looking at. But either way, I read that statistic and I thought, well, hang on a minute. If this was a product and that high amount of pupils, that, you know, that product wasn't working for that high amount of people, you would recall that product and you would say, you know, we need to go back to the drawing board with this because it's clearly not working for everyone. And that's a little bit how I feel about these young people in the education system. If it's that many, 35 a day or more, then it shows us something isn't working. And what I see within the education system is that it's set up for a certain type of pupil. And for that pupil, it works really, really well. And I know that because I was that pupil. So the education system worked really well for me. I had a really secure home life. I had support at home. I had my skills happen to lie academically. And I was able to focus and excel within the system. And therefore, I got a lot of feedback to me saying, you know, well done, you fit, you're part of this community, you're doing right, essentially. And then when I unpick about why that was, and I compare that to some of the young people that I work with, I mean, some of the kids I work with, they've been excluded from at least one, if not two, mainstream schools. I've worked with a kid who's been excluded from six mainstream schools. Six. And that just says to me again, something's wrong with the system. And these young people, I mean, I want to kind of bring it back to the title, Miss I Don't Give a Shit. Now, we might hear that or something similar a lot of the time, especially if we work in secondary, and even more so if we work in alternative provision. But what I invite right at the start of the book, I invite the reader to look at this and understand that behind that sentence is as many different experiences and meanings as there are pupils. And I think this is why I wrote the book, because I feel that the stories and the experiences that the young people have who are struggling with behaviour in schools, their needs are not being met in a lot of places that I see. I also see in mainstream some fantastic teachers really trying to meet the needs of these young people, but they haven't had the training. Most teachers I speak to have had about half a day's behaviour training when they did their teacher training, which was, what, 10 years ago. And it just baffles me, especially now that we're going through a pandemic, which is obviously affecting all our behaviour. And I'm just thinking, well, why have these teachers not been trained to deal with different behaviours that come up in that? Why are they not trained? Why have they not got the support as well? I think we're lacking a lot of support. And I talk a lot about SEMH, social, emotional, mental health issues, as an SEN, as a special educational need. There are barriers to learning. And it can be harder with these kids, because the barrier to learning could be, it could look like aggression. It could look like telling you to F off. It could look like a desk thrown at your face. And it's really hard, because we're humans too, in that moment to kind of think, oh, look, there's a barrier to learning. What we're more likely to think is, ah, let's get away. This there needs to be consequences. There needs to be punishments. And I think it's really important to say that I'm not against that. You know, definitely sometimes we do need consequences. And if we are going to support some of these young people who have been through the kind of trauma, abuse and neglect that is difficult for us to talk about, then we also need to be thinking long term about how we support these young people's needs. And that is where I bang my drum.
Absolutely. And I'm just thinking while you're talking there and kind of going, I'm going back over the previous kind of comments, but the reason that I mentioned some of those names, and you're absolutely right to pick me up on the fact that I picked four male educators, is because of the ideology behind some of the approaches. And I kind of picked them as, you know, pantomime kind of, you know, I can't think of the right word here, pantomime villains, you know, because it's, well, if you like this, you can't like that. If you do this, then you can't do that. Now, what I like about your book is that you're saying, well, you know, for students who potentially were like you, there is a certain way that you can regulate behavior, and it might be very different to how you do that with students that, you know, might express SEMH, SEND, and that can exist quite happily within a mainstream school. And that's something that we're working with Dave Whittaker quite a lot about recently, about trying to do that. And I think that that really comes through in the book, definitely. So, yeah. So what I'm going to move to now is talking about the chapter on boundaries. Now, I really found this useful, and I thought, I need to be doing more of this. So how important is holding boundaries for ourselves to help us hold one for our pupils?
Oh, my goodness. I am so glad you've picked up on this, Phil. There's a little backstage story to this. So that first chapter, which is about boundaries, negotiations and self-care for ourselves, so for the staff, I put that in. And then when I sent the book off to be proofread, one of my proofreaders was the fabulous Ian Gilbert. I don't know if you've interviewed him. He's written loads of books himself. He wrote the Working Class book. He's edited lots. He works with Crown Press. So in my head, I'm like, wow, you know, Ian Gilbert, wow, all these books. And he proofread my book, which was such an honour. And his feedback was great. Okay, great book, Adele. Yeah, really engaging. Great book, great book. This first chapter about self-care and boundaries and stuff. Great stuff, but just put it in later on. Start the book with some easy wins of behaviour tips. And I took that away. And, you know, part of me is thinking, oh, but Ian Gilbert knows because he's written loads of books and this is my first book and I don't know. But then I stopped and I thought, what is the biggest barrier to staff being able to confidently support behaviour in schools right now? It is the fact that most staff are running it empty. We have a staff that is an industry that is anxious, overwhelmed, overworked, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. And I know, just from a very personal experience, let's say there was one time that I hadn't eaten lunch, right? And the next lesson, there was this brilliant pupil on paper, low ability. And I started the lesson and he said to me, "Miss, you're being snappy." And I was like, okay, yeah, well, get on with your work. And he said, no, you're not usually this grumpy. What's up? And I just thought that was such a brilliant question. And I said to him, well, I haven't had my lunch. I was running my lunchtime club, Amnesty International Club. And I said, anyway, get on with your work. And he said, "Miss, please eat." And we had a rule in that school that I was in, it was mainstream. We weren't supposed to eat in front of the kids. And I told him that. I said, I'm not allowed to eat in front of you. And he stopped me and he went, "Miss, please eat something." Because he knew that me not taking care of myself, me not eating, would mean that his next double period of English GCSE was going to be a nightmare for him, because he could sense that I was on edge. Now, that is just a tiny, tiny example. And as I really invite the listener, as you're listening now, think of all the times when that's happened to you. If you haven't slept, if you you're in a particularly challenging part of your menstrual cycle, if you've just experienced racial abuse, if your kids didn't sleep last night, whatever it is, whatever factors, it means that when Joe comes in and he starts setting his blazer alight, it's going to be harder for you to respond to that in a way that's safe and useful for both him and the others and yourself. And so after I'd thought about this, after Ian had given me this feedback, I went back and I thought, no, I want to put this at the forefront of this book. Because yes, I believe that the education system as a whole needs a complete overhaul in terms of how we're looking after our teaching staff. But also I believe that we do have more power and more capacity to look after ourselves than we perhaps realise. Because I think in general, teachers are a very a giving martyrdom kind of crew. We're all very kind of, you know, oh, it's for the children. And I think actually there are small things that we can do every day that we can do to help ourselves, that ergo helps the kids. And So the good thing about Ian giving me that feedback was actually I rewrote the introduction to that chapter, and now it is, I'm going to use the word stonking. It's one of my favourite bits in the book, because I unpick and I explain to the reader, this is why we start with self-care and boundaries and how to do it and how to negotiate. Because if you can't hold a boundary for you to have lunch every day, then how are you going to hold a boundary when there is a vulnerable child in front of you who is extremely distressed, who's on the verge of self-destruction? And we need a staff who can hold those vulnerable young people. And the way to do that is to be able to hold boundaries for ourselves.
Absolutely. And I can do a signpost to an Ian Gilbert podcast. So The Working Class is one of my favourite books. And I have spoken to Ian about that. Live from Holland, as I remember. Yes, so we have had the pleasure. So I'll signpost that in the show notes. Thanks for the shameless plug there, Adele. And but I just, when I was reading it, I could just think of situations, and they're probably not as dramatic as maybe the ones that you outlined, but it might just be that, you know, like I said, you haven't eaten or you've been running around a lot. And I'm thinking particularly when my kids were younger and I was up and down in the middle of the night, and I can identify that with other people as well. And you think that your reaction to students, you can feel it with experience, that you don't react in the way that you normally would, which exacerbates issues. And then, you know, you can, and I've been guilty of it, and I've apologised afterwards, you know, perhaps blame that on the student sometimes, when actually, as Patrick Otley O'Connor is fond of saying, is, you know, put your own oxygen mask on first before you put anybody else's on.
Yes, exactly. And I think what I offer in the book are actual practical ways to do that as well. I mean, I do that throughout the book, but I think, oh, we need to hold our boundaries, oh, we need self-care, can become very general and abstract. And I really invite the reader to actually think, okay, what is the one thing? That's throughout the book, at the end of every chapter, I have the action box, which is what could you do next lesson, next week, and long term, so that you can actually implement these things as well.
Absolutely. Okay, so something that you talk about in the book is trauma-informed practice. And, you know, people may know little bits about this, but we've done quite a lot of work about it in Blackpool, but there's still a lot to kind of learn about that. And people got kind of a surface understanding of it, but you've gone into quite a lot of detail. So can you give an introduction to that and outline the importance of safety for our students?
Yes. So the way that I introduce this in the book is in the chapter, Safety First, Learning Second. And the challenge with this is that what looks safe to me is going to be different to what looks safe to you. And so I might set up a classroom, let's say we're in mainstream, and it's what I would call normal, which is not a word I like to use very often, but you've got the kids at their desks, let's say the door's closed, and I stand at the front and off we go. Now, for a young person, or in fact any person, who has experienced an adverse childhood experience or some form of trauma or abuse or neglect, they will have certain environments, certain sounds, certain relationships, certain people, etc., that will trigger them, which will tell that part of their brain that they are not safe. And from the outside, it can look like irrational, disruptive behaviour. And this is the challenge. So I'm sitting there in my mainstream classroom, let's say, I'll give you an example. And I was starting to teach Macbeth year 10. And all I did was put on the slide, and anyone who's taught Macbeth, you've probably done the same. It's some kind of gory image with like a crown and a dagger and all that kind of thing. And one of my young people just ran out of the classroom. This was mainstream. Now, obviously, running out of the classroom, if I look at my, whatever, my behaviour policy or my punishment consequences things, that shouldn't be happening. They shouldn't be running out the classroom. There should be a consequence for that. And to me, it's really important that we find out why that behaviour is happening. And it turned out that that young person has had a very challenging home life at that time, and had a very difficult experience around blood, right? And so that's why they ran out, because they saw the picture of the blood and it was too much and they went. I then found out later on that this young person was also self-harming, had anxiety needs, and was also a young carer for their sibling. So basically there was a lot going on. And their what looked like defiant behaviour, running out of my classroom in a strop, now, this is where trauma-informed practice comes in, because if you are aware that the behaviour that's being shown is actually communicating something, communicating something in which they don't feel safe, then it's my job. And then to me, this is where it gets exciting because I love this stuff. But to me, that gets exciting because I'm like, okay, so if I know a little bit about why this is happening, what trauma may have informed this, or just what experiences might have informed this, then I get to differentiate for that pupil. I get to create a safe environment for that pupil. And it's my job, you know, back to that theme, SEMH is SEND. It's my job to ensure that the education and the learning becomes accessible and I remove the learning barriers. Now, it took a while because I don't know if you know, Phil, but Macbeth Shakespeare's texts, they are set and you have to teach them for 2 years for the GCSE. And it was quite funny. The pastoral team got me in and they said, Adele, could this pupil just not do Macbeth? And I was like, no, because then they can't do the GCSE. So we really had to think out of the box of how we were going to enable, you know, allow access for this young person to access this text. And in the end, we did a lot around, I had to go to them before every lesson, let them know what was going to be discussed, what scenes we were going to do. I also had to spend some individual time with them, kind of informed time and things, supporting them around bits that they found tricky. I also, we also ensured that they were able to go to pastoral whenever they needed for this. And in the end, over 2 years, there were only two lessons that that pupil didn't attend, which I just see as an absolute success because we went from, I'm running out of your classroom, I'm never coming back in here, et cetera, defiance, to actually working with them and working with what was traumatizing them, and bringing back memories to enable them to be in the classroom. Now, that for me is an example of how we differentiate for SEMH and how trauma-informed practice helps this. I want to give just one other quick example. Do you remember the interview by Rachel in Chapter 2, Phil?
Yes, absolutely. Yeah.
Now, she is a person I was so... When I knew I was writing this book, I knew I needed her. She is a care experienced young person. Well, she was a care experienced young person. She's now been working in schools with SEMH pupils for 20 plus years. And now she has one of the best jobs in the world. She's a canine assisted therapist. Yes, folks, that's therapy with dogs supporting SEMH pupils. I love it. So she shared a story in the interview because I interview experts at the end of each chapter. And she shared a time where she said, I was in year nine and I remember the teacher kept saying, Rach, you need to, Rach, you need to, Rach, you need to. And she said to me, I couldn't even physically hear the instructions, let alone try and follow them. And so it came across to that teacher that I was being defiant and disruptive. She said, but I couldn't hear those words because I was flashbacking about the sexual abuse I had received the night before from a biological parent. And so with that in mind, you can kind of start to see why a trauma-informed practice becomes very, very useful if your true objective is for all of your young people to receive education.
Absolutely. And it's something that we've discussed previously. And in my opinion on this isn't necessarily one that the listener wants to hear, but it's kind of moved a lot on this. I think that what I said at the beginning about the way that you've got into it and the way that you articulate it and explain it there brings it to life. But when people have a surface level understanding of something like trauma-informed practice, they can potentially incorrectly attribute other behaviours to, you know, potentially trauma-informed. And I know, obviously, we don't know exactly what's going on, everyone's, but it can, in some circumstances, allow students to, how can I put this diplomatically, play the system a little bit in terms of, you know, behaviour. And that's where people find it difficult. But you're absolutely right. And this is something that, that we do because listeners will probably know I'm the DSL in school. So, you know, in terms of what kind of things I hear coming in and what kind of things I'm aware of, I do regularly checking with pastorals, checking with classroom teachers, not having to share all the details because that wouldn't be appropriate, but just, can you keep an eye on? Can you look after? Can you make sure, you know, it's anything about this particular student? So I totally understand what you said about trauma-informed practice, and I can 100% agree with its importance. I just think the application and the implementation of it are really important. And I think that this book would be a good place to start.
Can I talk into that moment as well between, because I hear that a lot too about kids playing the system and that kind of stuff. The way that I find is really successful with this is that, I don't know if you noticed, in none of that did I say, chuck your behaviour policy out the window. Mm. In none of that did I say, don't implement punishments or consequences. Because what can happen sometimes is you get to have the conversation with the kid. Okay, so you didn't do your homework, let's say, something really simple. You know that the rules in this school happen to be, if you don't do your homework three times, you're in a detention. So you can have the conversation. You know that's the consequence. That's going to happen. And it's that bit, Phil, that makes the difference with trauma-informed practice. I can still give the child a detention and I could use that detention to do some restorative practice. I could do that, use that detention to find out why the homework's not happening. And so it's not, and that way, if you have got a kid who's just playing the system and you say, the great thing about this is you use the same line. You say, okay, you haven't done your homework three times. You've got a detention and let's find out why. And then you find out they're just trying to wind you up. Well, fine. Then you respond to that in a different way. But finding out the kid's just winding you up or finding out the kid has just run away from home and is living with, I don't know, mum's new boyfriend who's not doing something nice to them, you're going to respond to that in a different way. And the great And I think you're right. The phrase trauma-informed practice, the kind of, it's the same with anything. I mean, it is the same with anything, any approaches, that once it kind of gets diluted, it kind of loses it. So I think the centre of it is keeping curious, you know, holding those boundaries. Young people with behaviour needs need boundaries just as much, arguably sometimes more than their counterparts. And looking at what's going on behind that, because it's only when we get to the root of it that we will be able to make a long-term difference.
Definitely. And we'll come to this later on, Adele. I mean, I know you do a lot of training. I've been keeping across your kind of Twitter timeline recently, and you do a lot of training in schools. And I mean, this is where this book is useful, because you're living it on a daily basis. And this is something that, you know, we have as the tagline, just talking to teachers. And obviously some people that have written books or have got a particular behaviour approach can't, for whatever reason, necessarily be in the classroom as much. And, you know, I'm one of them. I'm very rarely in the classroom. I should be more. But at least I'm in school. That's a start. But this is very much from that. And you can kind of get that from a classroom teacher's point of view. Right, well, I can still apply the policy here, but I can be a lot more pastoral, caring, understanding of the root cause of that. And, you know, have that discussion. And, you know, I love the way you explain that away then, in terms of that was a teacher's answer. You've had situations where students have tried to, you know, get away with, I'm not doing my homework because this has happened. Oh, really? Well, okay, you still got the detention. Let's talk about it. Oh, no, actually, I don't want to talk about it. Fine. Right. We carry on. And that's where this book is. It really is rooted in the classroom. Right. Can we do another controversial one while we're at it as well?
Go on.
Because I've seen this both sides as well. So, you know, the question is, does connection before correction work universally? And that's a deliberately provocative question, Adele, because I think the answer is nothing ever works universally. But just tell us where you stand on that one.
Okay, I'm going to give you a beautiful example. I had done some training in a school in London, and I was on the way back on the train, and there were these lads stood there. They're probably about 15, 16, you know, about a foot and a half taller than me or something. And it was in one of those moments, when you're listening to this, you know, who knows, but it was in one of those moments where face masks were compulsory on public transport. And these two youths had their masks on their chins, right? And I looked at them and I thought, I am going to go with they've just forgotten, because that's, you know, that's kind of what everybody was doing. They also didn't know me. They didn't know I was a teacher. Although I don't know if you have this, Phil, there is a thing when you talk to young people in public, they just automatically know you're a teacher. So
my kids say that to me all the time. It's like, Dad, yeah. don't.
Yes. I try not to. So in that moment, I had a choice. Now, I know, and this is something I talk into a lot, that teenagers in general are discriminated against in our society. The way that the general public treats teenagers is very, very different to how they would treat a toddler or a child or an adult. Anyway, that's another topic. But I had a choice in that moment. I could go to them and I could go in and try and correct them. I could say, lads, you're supposed to have your masks on, da 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 da. You know, I could have gone in like that. And then what really could have happened in that moment? They didn't know me. I didn't have a relationship with them. They didn't know me from Adam. or Eve, and they could have just told me where to go. And then what? I'm stuck on a tube opposite these teenage lads who've given me a load of abuse. You know, I didn't know what could happen. So instead, I connected with them first. And I just, because they were in their school uniforms, I said, oh, are you from that school that I'd just been training at? I kind of knew they weren't, but I thought it was a way in. And they said, no, we're from the one down the road. And I said, oh, right, okay, what's the difference between those? And I got them talking about their schools. And they immediately did that thing where they knew I was a teacher. So they suddenly stood up straight. It was quite funny. But as we were talking about their schools, all I did, and this doesn't work on a podcast, but all I did, I'm going to have to describe it, was mimed picking up the mask from their chin and putting it on their face. Phil, I did not say a word about the mask. Not one word. But because I had connected with them first, I was able to correct the behaviour to be socially acceptable for that context. And I was so excited after that because I thought, oh, I can go and write a blog on this and use it when people ask me. But it was just such an amazing example of kids I had no relationship with, kids I didn't know, completely out of context, not in school. They didn't even know I was a teacher. And yet it still worked. I connected with those young people first. And so by the time I came to correct them, they took it. Of course they did. If I'd have gone in hard and fast first, if you go in with correction first, you give the opportunity for someone to go into defense mode. You invite conflict. You invite someone protecting themselves. And so if you can connect with somebody first, then they are more likely to remain open to any kind of correction or opinion or whatever it is.
That's a great example. And this is very similar to something that I talked to Dave Whitaker about this. Because one of the biggest things that I learned from the school that I'm currently working at is the power of those relationships. So, I mean, I think I'll get the parable wrong because I do that. I'm very forgetful. But it was essentially around trying to get a coat off somebody. And, you know, the wind blew and blew and blew and the person held the coat tighter and tighter and wouldn't take the coat off. The sunshine, then they took it off themselves. So we extended that to kind of talk about those sort of situations that you're talking about that do happen in school. You know, quite often we just happen to have a rule about coats in schools. I'm not saying it's right. I'm not saying it's wrong. We just happen to have one. But if you say, get your coat off, it might work for some. But there are others where it's, oh, morning, how are you? Oh, yeah, good weekend. What about this? Oh, by the way, you know, probably caught up. And it's done then, isn't it? I think that the difficulty is, and obviously you're in a classroom, is that then, and this is not the fault of what you're talking about, it's the fault of the implementation of it and the fact that people don't get the full picture, is that then people say, well, I need to have a relationship with every single student in the class, know about their football team, what their favourite YouTuber is, or what, you know, well, I shouldn't mention TikTok, should I? Or whatever is going on there, you know, and that's not what you're saying, is it? You're saying in situations where it might be difficult, it's wise to have that kind of connection before you do anything, particularly in public as well.
Yeah, I mean, I want to give you an example of where I got it completely wrong as well. There was a young person, we had a rule in a school, mainstream school I was working, you know, it was about the length of girls' skirts. And this is classic, and this is something that I am always advocating to help staff with. I'd been in a meeting with some senior managers who were doing the kind of drill of, okay, oh, now we need to really come down on this skirt length. We really need to be strict about it. We really need to get it better. Da, 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 da. I came out of that meeting all fired up with, this is the rule. It needs to be held. This is the rule. You know, that had been drilled into me. And I saw this girl who I'd taught a little bit, but not that much. And so, of course, I was like, great. Here's my chance to get them all in line. I said, look, your skirt's not... you need to sort your skirt out. It's the wrong length. Da, 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 da. Now this, because I'm an out bisexual teacher, this girl knew that. And she turned round to me and said, why are you looking at my skirt? Why are you looking at my legs, miss? You perv, why are you looking at my legs, miss? And I froze. And actually, that gave me a big empathy for male teachers, I must say, because I had never experienced that before, that kind of... you know, provocation, that the reason I was looking at her skirt was because I happened to be bisexual. And I didn't know what to do. And it was because I hadn't connected with her. I'd come out of this meeting, all kind of, what do you say, guns blazing. all guns blazing. And I had spoken to her in a way that didn't connect her and actually put her defense up. So what did she do? She threw something back at me, and kind of too right, should she? But it really didn't work. So yeah, there's the two examples.
No, they are good examples, absolutely. And again, you know, the case studies and the things that you talk about at the end of the chapters are really useful for people to kind of get this and get this right in your classroom. And, you know, I'm forever grateful to the school that I'm at now, because I was just wasn't like that. I was the person who was, and it's, I shouldn't really be saying this, should I? Who was the barking down the corridors and the expecting the compliance without necessarily looking into the reasons behind it. It's been a huge eye opener the last 2 years in terms of the difference that you can make by, you know, having that kind of connection first. So, you know, but it doesn't mean that I'm going to be discussing everyone's favourite football team in year 11 science, and they might not know what they all are, because I might have a relationship with those students that's based on, right, I know quite a lot about science, I'm going to teach you quite a lot about science, but if there's any problems, we'll look into it. But that's the probably the sum total of that relationship to start with.
There's actually, when I was researching for this book, there is a... I'm going to forget the name now, but there's someone that I've quoted, I can't remember the name, Sowen, I think. And they talk about, yes, it's really useful for teaching staff to know some of the context of what students are going through. However, there's actually a line, and that line is, of course, movable. But if we get too involved in the young person's life, then we are at danger of not giving them what we're there for, which is the education. So I love what you're saying about, you know, in your science classroom, your job is to give them a science education. Yes, it's to remove any barriers that might come up, whether that's dyslexia, whether that's because the heating's off, whether that's because there are trauma needs that need supporting, whatever the barrier is. But your aim is still to give those children an education in science. And I think that's really useful to hold on to in all of this. It's not that we need to know every single thing about the young person, but we need to know what the barriers are for them learning in my classroom.
Absolutely. Okay, so in terms of the next question, and it's again something that we've kind of focused quite a lot on recently, thanks to the assistant head who's in charge of this. I'd give him a name, check it out, but I don't think he listens, so he'll know who he is if I do this. And he did a big piece of work around unpicking the percentage of students that had got behaviour points, as we call them. And he said it was something like 3% of students were the ones who were causing, you know, 80-odd% of the issues. And looking at the other students who weren't being recognised, and he's put a huge system in around praise and recognition, PAR system that he's calling it. But it's something that you talk about in the book, isn't it, about positive behaviour. So how does the listener teach that positive behaviour?
ABC, here you go. So how do you teach positive behaviour? Okay, so the first thing, going back to chapter one, is that we have it ourselves. There is really, 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 really no point in standing in front of a class and yelling, "Be quiet, you need to be silent." Because you as the teacher, this is something Kate McAllister talks about in the interview I have with her, the teacher is the kind of conductor for the class. I'm going to get my science wrong. Sorry, I finished at year 10. But the conductor, the teacher is the conductor. So we have the power/responsibility to determine what the culture is in a classroom, what the language used is like, what the relationships are like, what their energy is like. And we know this because different teachers hold classrooms in different ways. So if we are standing there shouting and screaming to be silent, it is very unlikely that we'll get it unless we are, as you referred to a bit ago, Phil, unless we are just looking for compliance. I can scare a child into being quiet. I used to be an opera singer. I have a very loud voice and I can scare a child into that. Now, is scaring a child into compliance useful for their learning? It's a useful question to ask. Because something that I come across often, people, you've talked about earlier about this kind of binary and villains and fairies or something around behaviour, is that actually it's going to be different for every situation, for every context. And so if we really want to foster positive behaviour, we need to begin with ourselves. How are we with the young people? What kind of language do we use? What kind of body language do we use? What are our expectations with them? How do we deal with failure in our classroom? Is failure allowed? Is failure not allowed? Is failure of certain things allowed? Is failure of not certain things allowed? So it's really beginning with ourselves in that sense. And then the next stage of this that I go into the book is the remembering that behavior is different in different contexts. Okay, so let's say I have a female partner, right? And in this country, in England, that's kind of neither here nor there. Still do receive homophobia and biphobia, but it's okay, right? There are 11 countries in this world where I could be imprisoned and possibly put to death for having a female partner. Now, the behavior is exactly the same. I'm in love with someone, maybe I have sex with them, maybe I fight with them over the washing up. The behavior is exactly the same, but my context, which country I'm in, is going to determine whether that behavior is seen as positive or negative. And let's take that back into the classrooms. So if you bounce a ball in my English classroom, I'm probably going to see that as negative behavior. It's not very often I need a ball bouncing in my classroom. If you bounce a ball in PE, in basketball, in a certain way, it's praised. If you bounce a ball in an exam, and I really need to research this, do you just fail? You know, I'm not sure. So when we go back to that kind of fostering positive behavior, we cannot assume that every young person knows what positive behavior looks like in a different context. And this is even more relevant to young people who have challenging home lives, or young people who perhaps have a very different culture at home, maybe a different language, maybe a different philosophy or way of being. You know, and we know that. We know that schools in Britain are required to teach British values, whatever they may or may not be. And at home, we know that there are young people who perhaps don't live by those things. So we have young people who are in different positions. And I refer to Rosemary Allen's TEDx talk in my book, who talks about when we have a child who can't read, we teach them. When they can't write, we teach them. When they can't ride a bike, we teach them. When they don't behave, we punish them. And it's just daft. It's just really, really daft. So that positive behavior has to start with us. And it also has to start with the thought that they might not always get it right. They are learning. They are children. Even the old ones who are 2 foot taller than me and don't know what to do with their limbs, they are still children. They are still learning. And alongside that, so it's always the two, there may be consequences. How many times are they allowed to fail at tucking their shirts in before I give them a consequence? Now, if I just give them the consequence, or if I just give them the punishment, I would argue they're not necessarily learning anything apart from good, bad, which is a very binary, unuseful way to think around behaviour. Whereas if, again, as we were talking before, if I'm finding out why that shirt's not being tucked in, I mean, that's a tiny example, but, you know, if I'm finding out why, then I can address it with them to help them achieve positive behaviour around shirt tucking in line with the behaviour policy and uniform policy within my school. And so it's about modelling it ourselves. It's about fostering a community and a culture of positive behaviour. And then it's about letting young people have the chance to give it a go, have the chance to fail, and being really explicit when they do fail at the rules that are required in your certain school, in your certain classroom on a certain day. When they do fail, what happens? How are they treated? And how can they learn from that? How can that be dealt with so that we can get back to the learning and the education?
Absolutely. So here comes shameless plug, Adele, for my own book, which I've nearly finished, finally. It's taken a long, long time.
Exciting.
But it's very, I'm going to link it back to yours seamlessly, he says here. So I started teaching in 2000. Yes, listener, I am that old, yes. I do enjoy those comments of you taught my mum. Which is always great when you find out how old the mum is. Anyway, I'm waffling. If we get back to one of the kind of the best intentioned but worst pieces of advice I was given was by a deputy head who was, and she was a tremendous deputy head of a all-girls school, and the kids loved her, the staff respected her, great, great teacher. But towards the end of her career, perhaps her empathy for an ex-football coach turned teacher who's trying to control, you know, 16-year-old girls when he's 23, was not as it should be. And one of the pieces of advice that she gave me at the time was, she just said, "Oh, do you have problems with Charlotte? I just can't understand it. They all work so well for me."
Oh,
and I just thought, yeah. I know what you mean. And, you know, and by what they absolutely did work very well for her. And not through it. She wasn't in any way, you know, controlling or a shouting like that. It was just that this kind of sheer magnetism of her personality plus her subject knowledge. But I just thought, I can start taking this really personally, that these girls will work very well for Mrs. And I won't mention her name. but it won't work well for me. So you talk about this in the book. How hard is it for the reader and listener not to take behaviour personally, and why is that so important?
Oh, this is such a good point. And I just want to speak into a bit as well about your experience there. I am frustrated at the moment about the current rhetoric that is coming out of our government, Department of Education and the media that seems to suggest there's one way to do behaviour. Because when we think about there's one way to do behaviour, what that also says, ergo, is there's one type of person who can do behaviour. And often the person who pops into my head, a child growing up in the 90s, is the demon headmaster. And the message that sends to staff, and I'm thinking particularly of early career staff, is that if I don't deal with behaviour in this way, then I can't do it. And I have to pass it on to somebody else. And we all know that when a teacher can't manage the majority of behaviour themselves and they always have to pass it on, that's when a lot more problems come up. I'm sure you see that in your school. So this idea of, you know, like she said to you, well, they're fine for me and they're not for you. And then we're in danger of all trying to emulate one type of way of approaching behaviour. And it just doesn't work. I mean, I don't know about you, Phil, but when I try and do something, I've got colleagues who the way they do behaviour, they are very kind of cool on like kids on the street, high-fiving, fist pumping. When I try and do that, I sound like Julie Andrews from the Midlands pretending to be Ali G. Like it just doesn't work. And the kids see through it and they're like, what the hell are you doing, miss? Just like literally just be yourself. And I think this is why behaviour is so challenging and yet brilliant, because it's never done. It's never finished. And so coming back to that personally thing, as we are each discovering our own ways to approach behaviour in a way that works for us, in a way that's sustainable, so doesn't lead to burnout, in a way that might be different from the colleague down the corridor, that's okay, as long as we're all conforming to the guidelines around the behavioural policy, as long as there is some form of consistency, we can still approach behaviour differently. And we're going to get personal things coming at us in different ways. And this is where we come to our own reflection and our own self-awareness. And it was really interesting. I interviewed 10 people for this book, and all of them said, in some way or another, self-reflection and self-awareness is the key to helping you be more confident with behaviour with your pupils. Because let's say, so I know, as I said, I'm bisexual, and the kids know this. And every so often they will try, they think that's a weak spot. They think that's going to bother me. So I get caught, I mean, I don't want to go too explicit, Phil, but I do work in proofs and SEMHs. I get called all sorts of things, let's say. And often my sexuality will come up, right? So, oh, miss, you're gay. Blah, 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 blah. I'm not gay, I'm bisexual. But what, you know, do we know the difference? Blah, blah, blah. And what they discover very quickly is they can't trigger me on that. I'm not going to take that personally. In fact, when I hear that, I'm excited, because I'm like, here's some kids who want to learn. Great. Here's maybe some kids who need to know more about this topic for whatever reason. However, on the other side, I'm 36 years old and I've just started getting grey hairs. I've never had grey hairs before. This is a new part of my life. So I'm like, now if a kid starts picking up on my grey hairs, how am I going to feel? Ah, it's going to feel really personal, because it's a topic or it's an area for myself that I haven't quite come to terms with yet. And so I know, now this is a self-awareness piece around not taking it personally, I know that topic, I might be a little bit more vulnerable. I'm going to use that word. And so I know that I am more likely to slip into my defense, into my snappiness, into my, okay, you shouldn't be talking to a teacher like that. you know, behavior point. I'm more likely to do that on that topic than I am if they ask me anything about my sexuality. And so because I have that self-awareness, because I know that, I then can do the prevention work for myself. So I can know, okay, if they say that, I can program my brain to go, it's not personal. Okay, so question 3A, what are we doing? And I can just divert it. And I don't need to take that as personally. There's also another layer to this, which is around teenagers. I don't think we've got time now, but you can read about it in the book. There's also absolutely loads, and I go into the workings of the teenage brain, which is absolutely fascinating, about why some of their behaviour comes across as very personal. And to any parents or carers of teenagers, you'll also be laughing at this right now as well. But that extreme behaviour that, or seemingly extreme behaviour that can come out of teenagers sometimes and can feel very, very personal, there are biological brain developmental reasons for that behaviour. And I have worked with teaching staff, parents, carers, and trained on this topic, and they come out going, oh my goodness, so I don't need to take every eye roll, every F off personally. It's not about me. And once you know about how the teenage brain works, then that makes a lot of sense as well.
Yeah, definitely. And it was one of the great things about joining the new school again that I mentioned here is that everybody has potentially something that the students will target. Mine's very straightforward, which is the reason why I'm not on camera. So my lack of hair, Adele, has been something that I've been, I've been quite open about since I was about 21, to be honest. As soon as I saw a rather shiny patch, I thought, well, I'm going to get rid of that. And I have done, you know, for 20 odd years. But that normally is the target. So the previous school I worked at, I was unlucky enough to be the only gentleman without any hair. So it was, you know, I was universally known as the bald one. When I joined the new school, I was delighted to see that I was in in good company. So it became less of an issue. But you're right in terms of, you know, sometimes how do you handle that? Do you get upset about that? You know, there's certain lines you've got to draw there. But it is hard, and particularly at the start of your career, to not take things personally.
And then I would really love, I mean, like, I really want to take your experience of there, of being the only gentleman with a bald head, is that then think of the only black or Asian member of staff in the school.
Yep.
Then think of the only member of staff whose first language isn't English. Then think of the member of staff who is disabled. Then think of, you know, whatever it is, maybe think of the only staff who's in the LGBT community. We all have different experiences of life, and we're all different. We're all different humans. So we are all going to be triggered. And I think it's really important to say, we will all have something. And it could be you've just been through a divorce. And that's going to be, you know, if a kid picks up on that, that could undo you. It could, you know, it could be you're going through the menopause. It could be whatever. You know, we're all experiencing, and particularly around the pandemic, individual, sometimes very heightened emotional things that if they got brought up, we're more likely to take that personally. And it's about getting the support. It's about leaning into your colleagues in that way. And if there are big things that are going on, letting colleagues know so that, I mean, I've done it before. When I was going through a challenging time, I said to a trusted colleague, look, I'm on my edge. If something happens with, you know, this class that I sometimes a bit fruity, can I just call on you? It's about putting that in place before it happens.
Yeah, definitely. And it's interesting that you mentioned about some things that maybe do trigger you more, because obviously, you know, I've got used to the lack of hair, but you said about the grey hair. And the thing for me is I've been struggling since having COVID at the beginning of the month. I've been struggling to get back. And as you can tell, I'm still not anything like 100% right 4 weeks on. But the number of people that said, oh, you don't look well. And I think, yes, that's not terribly helpful, is it? And you get more upset about that than you do about anything else that anybody else is saying. Yeah. So, yeah, it is hard to do. But I think you give some really good suggestions about how you can kind of do that. And Adele, for the last question, if that's okay. So you talked about in the last answer about the importance of a support team, and you kind of given a concrete example there, a colleague that you can call on at a particular time. So how important is that support team for teachers?
I mean, I don't think there's another answer to that, is there? Not from my perspective. Having a support team enables us to teach. I mean, there's an interview I do with Dr. Emma Kell in the book, and she talks about being in one of the most on paper, inverted commas, challenging schools in a city, London. And she had a blast. She said it was, you know, the behaviour was the most extreme she's ever worked with. It was a special school. And yet, because the team were great, they did it. And on the other side, she was worked in a mainstream school where, you know, on paper, kids all fairly good with behaviour, et cetera, et cetera. And yet the culture between the staff was competitive. It was blaming. It was, if you gave out too many behaviour points, you were put on disciplinary. If you gave out too many praise points, then it was questioned as well, like all this kind of thing. And she had to leave that school. So you can see how it makes such a difference. And actually, the way I see it, I mean, when people say to me, and even mainstream teachers say to me, how do you work with those kids who've been excluded? How do you cope with it? You know what? That's my job. My job is to work with, like, to support those young people. I believe that education should be for all of our young people, and that it's my job to remove barriers that would stop any young person learning. So, I mean, a great example, once I went into a classroom and I met a new student who threw a pen at me. That's the first thing that he did. And I said, oh dear, don't want that. Okay. Then he threw a book at me. So then I reacted. I wasn't feeling safe. This wasn't good practice, but I wasn't feeling safe. And I reacted and I tried to pull rank. I said, look, I'm a teacher. You should not be throwing things at me. He then went to throw a desk at me. At that point, the TA, who luckily for me was fantastically experienced, turned around and said, Adele, please leave. Now, it was a bit weird because, like, why is the TA telling the teacher to leave? And I felt like, oh, I'm a behaviour and education specialist. I'm supposed to be able to do this. I'm rubbish. So I went out and, like, licked my ego. But then the TA came back to me and she told me that that young person had been abused by women in his family. And so every new woman that he met, he did that. He did, which you would do. You know, that's really useful survival behavior. If you have been abused by women, adults in your family, then guess what? When you meet a new woman adult, you are going to be defensive and you're going to try and protect yourself, which is what he was doing. But the reason I come back to this for the team is because I trusted her enough. She had the relationship with this kid. I didn't. And so she was even able to talk to me, not rudely, but just very, you know, directly, Adele, you need to leave. But then afterwards she came back, she gave me that support. She said, this is what's happened. This is why. And it turned out, because I was working part time in that school, it turned out that somebody had forgotten to give me the communication piece about this new young pupil. And there was basically a breakdown within the system of communication. And that situation of me going into that classroom shouldn't have happened. But because I was part time staff, someone had forgotten to email at me or something like that. But you can see there that the team is so important, because what she did, that TA, she kept me safe and she kept the young person safe and she stopped it escalating. Now on paper, she told the teacher to go and she's the TA. It sounds wrong. But if you're working in a team, it's absolutely irrelevant. Your job title is irrelevant. And I think that's why I love working with young people with behaviour needs so much, because it really, really tests what your practice is, and they test your teams and how cohesive you are as a team with your colleagues. Also, I talk about in the book getting support outside of school, having different people, especially those friends that are really useful, who really don't want to talk about schools or kids, so that you've got support in all different kinds of ways. And I list in the book different areas that you can look out for. Where is your support? And even if you don't feel like you need it now, it's really useful to know that it's in place, because it is always when rather than if with teaching, that you will need some support at some time in different ways, whether that's practically with strategy or pedagogy in the classroom, or whether that's emotional support for yourself, or whether it's just, I need to go out and have a lot of fun.
Definitely. And if it's on, you know, in terms of concrete support as well, then they could do no better than to go to the book, he says, in seamless link to end the podcast. So listen, to remind us, we've been talking about Miss I Don't Give a Shit, Engaging with Challenging Behaviour in Schools, with Adele. Adele, just to finish off with, I know that, like, I've mentioned it a few times, and you're doing a lot, aren't you, in terms of training sessions, etc. So would you be able to signpost, and we'll put it in the show notes as well, any upcoming events and workshops that you might have, and of course, crucially, where listeners can get hold of the book?
Thank you. So to answer that question first, I really encourage my readers, if at all possible, to buy the book from a company that pays its taxes and treats its staff ethically. It is available at your local bookshop and you can order it in. It takes a couple of days if they don't have it on the shelf. So that's that plug. and then, yes, there I am travelling up and down the country at the moment, doing a lot of support for schools. And I'm excited. You've probably seen it if you've been following my Twitter, Phil. I have also just opened the We Give a Shit Behaviour membership. And the reason this has come about is because I am often hosting events with lots of people within my community who are looking for this. They're looking for support and practical strategies of how to get in the classroom and how to support some of the more tricky behaviour in there, and to support all of our young people. And what I discovered as I go up and down the country training, etc., so many people say to me, oh my goodness, you're so positive and inspiring and motivating, but you're only here for a day. Or if I'm working with a school on a kind of short-term project, I might be there for a few weeks, a few months. And so I've created this online membership. It's 12 months as a way for teachers, teaching staff to receive ongoing support so that when something happens in the morning and you've locked yourself in the cupboard to get away from it, you can come into our space and be supported both by myself on behaviour, and also we have guest speakers. And it's also a place for us to come in together as a community. What I've discovered since writing this book, so many people are contacting me saying, yes, that makes complete sense. You are talking about stuff that happens in the classroom, and now I've got things I can do with it. And why is this conversation not happening more? The conversation that behavior is not about this approach or that approach. It's about what works for you in your classroom with your pupils in your context right now during a global pandemic. And how do we make that sustainable for our staff? So if that's the kind of environment you want to be a part of, then come along to and join us. My website is adelbateseducation.co.uk. Over there, you can also find information if you are a school leader or governor and you want me to come into your school or do a longer-term project with you, you can find out over there. You can also follow me on Twitter at adelbateszz. That's adelbateszz. And do come and say hello. I heard you on Phil's podcast and tag him in too. That's lovely to see that's working. And I'm also on the LinkedIn machine now, and I think that's just Adele Bates. So yeah, that I think that's all of the things for now, Phil.
Fantastic. Right. Well, again, I just want to kind of emphasize how much I enjoy the book and how much I intend to go ahead and kind of share that and use that with other teachers. And, you know, particularly within our kind of, we have a lot of nurture groups and alternative provisions. I'm going to share that as well there. So thank you so much for your time today. And I really, really appreciate it.
Thank you.
And hopefully I'll see you on the road at some point.
Yes, in real life. Thank you.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.
Talking to teachers about academic research and evidence-based practice with continuing professional development at PNA 1977 on Twitter.
Nimmer's Netter, just talking to teachers.